Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tourists are being ordered to evacuate the Florida Keys ahead of Hurricane Wilma, which has developed into the most intense Atlantic storm ever recorded today. Forecasters say the storm, now with sustained winds of around 175 miles per hour, could threaten southwestern Florida by the weekend. Meteorologist Timothy Schott joins us from the National Weather Service in Washington. Timothy, put this in context. I mean, it is a record breaker, isn't it?
This is a record breaker in several characteristics. As far as the number of named storms for the year, we're up to 21 now with Wilma. And also this morning, we set the new minimum pressure record that we have for hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin.
What does that mean?
That means that this is one of the most intense hurricanes on record that we have. Mm. You can measure in terms of wind speed. You can also measure in terms of pressure. And pressure was extremely low this morning.
Yeah, well, poor Florida. We've been concentrating on the rest of the Gulf Coast, but Florida has also been hit by all of these, this string of hurricanes. What do you think they should expect for the weekend?
I think anyone living in the entire state of Florida needs to be listening to media in the future track of the storm. Looks like the peninsula will be affected one way or another by the storm as we approach late Friday into Saturday. The storm looks to move very quickly across the peninsula and then out in the Atlantic, and then we'll be following the storm after that as well.
And where is it now? In other words, if it's so huge now, is it going to go over some land masses and which might reduce it?
Fortunately, there'll be little interaction with land, but there still will be impacts throughout the Caribbean. Currently, it's about 325 miles southeast of Cozumel, Mexico, and it maintains an overwater path for quite some time until we do expect it to cross the state of Florida over the weekend. The storm will weaken somewhat over the next several days as it moves into somewhat less favorable atmospheric conditions.
But then, as we know, Katrina weakened as well and still packed a wallop. Timothy Schott, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, talking about Hurricane Wilma bearing down on Florida. Tim, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And we'll keep an eye on that. And now to Iraq, where there are two stories we want to tell you about, and then we'll continue to watch for you. We have just learned that a Baghdad-based reporter for the Guardian newspaper of London has vanished in Iraq. 33-year-old Rory Carroll was on assignment there, and the Guardian website has posted a statement in Arabic seeking to find him.
أكدت جريدة الغارديان اليوم أن مراسلها في بغداد روري كارول وجنسيته إيرلندية اختفى.
The Guardian says Rory Carroll may have been taken by a group of armed men. Here Now listeners may recall our conversation with Rory back in September when he told us about an insurgent sniper named Juba who was targeting U.S. soldiers.
Juba is just a nickname. They've never seen him. They have no idea what he looks like. They don't even know for sure if he is a man. They assume it's a man. And don't even know if he's Iraqi. There's some suspicion that he could be a Syrian or he could be Lebanese. All they know is that he's lethal, that he's an excellent shot, and that he appears to have been very, very well trained.
That's Rory Carroll. Last September, all of our calls to Rory's cell and satellite phones were met with recordings saying that the phones had been turned off. The group with Reporters Without Borders says that 72 journalists and media assistants have been killed in Iraq since the start of the war. Well, staying in Iraq, earlier today, nearly 2 years after he was captured hiding in a hole, former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein went on trial. As he has before in court, he refused to cooperate, other than to plead not guilty to the charges. Here's a portion of his exchange with the judge, as translated on the BBC.
This is the Iraqi Criminal Court, a special court, and you're here to be tried. Have you ever been a judge before? There is no room for such talk in this court. No, there is.
Saddam Hussein also made this statement.
I would like to say that I refuse to answer these questions. Because this court is not legal. And I reserve my constitutional right not to proceed.
The confrontation became physical during a break in the trial when Hussein scuffled with guards as he tried to leave the courtroom. Hussein and several associates are being charged with the killings of 143 men in a town called Dujail. The prosecution alleges the killings were orchestrated by Saddam in revenge for a failed assassination attempt in 1982. The trial was adjourned until November 28th, when the prosecution will begin presenting its case, calling witnesses and presenting evidence. Sources expect that phase to last anywhere from several months to several years. Well, Saddam on the stand. It's a sight many Iraqis never thought they'd see, and that includes our next guest, Zainab Salbi. She grew up in Iraq's upper class. When she was 11 years old, her father became Saddam Hussein's pilot, and Ammo, or uncle, as Zainab called Saddam, would often drop by the house to chat or tell her parents how he'd murdered his mistress. Their life was one of privilege, but also it was a gilded cage.
Every instinct in me, survival, loyalty, anger, horror, resentment, guilt, and most of all, fear, conspires to prevent me from speaking Saddam Hussein's name out loud. The fact that I use his name now, acknowledge a personal connection to him at all, is for me a watershed, no matter how trivial that might seem. He wasn't related to me or my family by blood, but some of my childhood and virtually all of my teenage weekends were merged with his nonetheless. I was taught to call him Ammu, and he treated me like a niece. Though it disturbed me, I can still reach back and conjure up some few fond memories of him. I would convict him of crimes against humanity without a second thought, but not because he singled me out for unkindness.
Zainab Salbi witnessed firsthand Saddam's terrible grip on her family and her country. She fled to the U.S. through an abusive arranged marriage, which she then left and began working on international women's rights. She even appeared on Oprah. But she never talked about the fact that she knew Saddam. Now she's written an astonishing memoir. It's called Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam. And Zainab joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You say you can't even say his name. Obviously, you said it when you read it just now. Do you say it in conversation or?
I am still very emotional when I talk about his name. I feared for so long that if I ever tell anybody about my connections to him or the fact that I knew him, that my face would disintegrate and everything about me, my identity, my accomplishments, my thoughts, my feelings will go and his face will take over. And I'm still emotional about it as I talk about it.
Yeah, well, and I can see that now. This is the first time you're really talking publicly about, being in Saddam Hussein's inner circle. How did this come to happen? I mean, your parents weren't very political. Your father just happened to be a good pilot.
Part of what Saddam did when he first took over power is try to meet different sectors of the Iraqi population. My parents were from the sector who were familiar with Western culture, Western educated, loved Western music and things like that. And it's impossible to say no to Saddam. Saying no to Saddam means your execution, your imprisonment, the loss of your assets and everything you have. And so despite of their resistance, and I talk in the book about their attempt at least to resist it, there was a time in which it was too late. My father keeps on saying we kept on thinking that we can manage the relationship. Until one day it was too late, and he was like a poison, leaked gas in our house where we breathed him slowly, and we tried to survive and surrender and try to survive again slowly.
Yeah, but you're observing this from a very small vantage point. You're a young child initially, then, as you said, a teenager. I mean, your parents realized early on that there was something very menacing about Saddam Hussein. But still, there was glamour, there were trips, there were parties. Can you paint some of that?
There was definitely a nice part of him, a charming part of him. He laughed, he had a good smile, he liked clothes, he liked music, all of these things. But the other part of it is that whatever he liked, he wanted to make sure that others are also liking it. I remember one trip We went out and he was showing us his houses. And he kept on saying, is this beautiful? And we all had to repeat with the very same exact excited tone. Yes, uncle, it is very beautiful.
Amo's uncle.
Amo, yes. It's very beautiful. Part of the dynamics of his relationship was divide and conquer. Divide and conquer. Make everyone suspicious of each other. That's how he, in my opinion, controlled most of Iraqi society. There is a part of me from day one when I met him, I knew that he is the man who executed my best friend's father. I knew that he was the man who was responsible for the deportation of 200,000 Shias, and my mother's family, at least, were part of those who got deported, and my mother was in hiding for 6 months fearing deportation simply because of her ethnic origin. And the more I grew, I started noticing the difference between my mom's friends who used to come in our house in the 70s and dance and laugh and dance, and in the 80s when they would come to our house, they would whisper and cry. My mother would go with them in the middle of our garden, and we'd have the radio on very, very loud, and they would whisper together because we feared everything. We feared the walls. We feared even our shadows sometimes, lest they spy on us.
A friend of yours leans over and whispers to you once about how he gassed the Kurds. He gassed his own countrymen up in the north. And this, what a thing to know that you were jetting off in a sports car with a mass murderer.
You know that you are vulnerable at every single moment. Being close to the devil only gets you that much closer to danger. It does not protect you from danger. So I learned not to express emotions, not even to my mother, because I didn't want anybody to know what is in my head. And the story about the helicopter, for example, there was the simplest stories in which he was duck hunting in a very cruel way, as I saw it, surrounding the ducks in
helicopters.
With five helicopters. And I remember their screams so loud as I remember seeing his face laughing with his rifle in his hand, shooting them. I cried and I started screaming, this is a massacre, this is a massacre. And that simple emotion caused my mom to be afraid. She ran towards me, you know, pushed my head towards her chest and started hushing me. She's like, shh, you know, to calm me down so the soldiers would not see me cry, because that by itself could be dangerous. And so if the most innocent emotions were dangerous, the political one were definitely very dangerous to express.
We're talking to Zainab Salbi. Her new book talks about life in Saddam Hussein's inner circle. Her father was Saddam Hussein's pilot. And, you know, as we listen to you, people are going to ask, why didn't you leave? Your family went to Seattle on shopping excursions. He sometimes gave $10,000 to your mom and her friends to go somewhere else to shop. Why didn't they just leave?
That was the struggle of the whole family. I grew up overhearing my parents arguing with each other to leave, not to leave. Whatever your individual decision may be, the punishment is not necessarily on you only, but on your family. So had my parents left, my cousins, my uncles, my aunt were definitely vulnerable for punishment because of their individual acts. But beside that, when I much later, got a chance to talk with my father and asked him, why didn't you leave? And his answer was, this is my home. This is my home. Part of my resistance was to stay in my home.
And Zainab Salbi, her memoir is called Between Two Worlds. It tells of growing up in the inner circle of Saddam Hussein, her father, Saddam Hussein's pilot. Zainab's going to be back with us in a moment to talk about how she worked with women around the world before she recognized her own abuse and is just now telling her own story. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our talk with Zainab Salbi, who's breaking her silence about her relationship with Saddam Hussein in a new memoir entitled Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam. Her father was Saddam Hussein's pilot, and as a youngster and a teenager, she and her family spent almost every weekend in the company of Saddam Hussein, a man they all feared but had to call uncle or ammo. On the eve of the first Gulf War, she escaped to the U.S. through an arranged marriage with an Iraqi in America, but her husband was abusive. She escaped him as well, eventually founded a rape crisis support group called Women for Women International. And Zainab, your husband raped you. I don't know how comfortable you are talking about that, but it occurred to me that in your book, your marriage seems to parallel the relationship that you and other Iraqis had with Saddam Hussein.
Oh, definitely. The dynamics that my parents had with Saddam Hussein or other Iraqis had with Saddam Hussein was that of an abusive relationship. In my case, it's funny because my mother, I grew up with my mother saying that I have to be a strong woman, that I have to be an independent woman, that I am not to let anybody to touch me the wrong way or hurt me the wrong way or anything like that. And she would tell me that I would have to marry for love and I would have to be passionate about the man that I'm marrying. Yet all of a sudden, as I'm 20 years old, I see her, you know, arranging a marriage for me in America to a stranger 13 years older than me. I remember the moment in which my father saying, maybe we should just cancel this marriage. And we were in Chicago at the time and my mother cried and cried and cried. She's like, I can't take her back. I will not take her back to Iraq with me. Mm. And I didn't want to see my mother crying, and so I went for it.
And you later found out, I want to jump ahead to the end of your tale, which is bringing your mother, this vibrant, very modern-thinking, professional woman who is turned into something of a palace matron, a bird in a cage, as she would describe herself. When you're young, she attempts suicide. Towards the end of her life, she had a terrible illness. And you brought her here to care for you to the United States. You ask her a very difficult question as you start to realize how important it was for her to get you out of Iraq. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. She was so afraid. If he wanted me, there was nothing they could do. So
it seems obvious, too, because at this point in your narrative, you've told us the stories of how he invited you into his car, he gave you a car for a present, how he looked at you a certain way.
There was a part of me that I realized it, and there is a part of me that I didn't, because there's a part of that he was just uncle, ammo. And there was, and I was more aware about what he did to other women, how he raped women in the so-called People's Day that he had to consult women, how he raped women in different villages and in different towns. And so I was there's a part of me like that I was aware, and there was a part of me that wanted to deny it.
Well, and there's a part of you that increasingly began to ask, had he raped my mother because of the way your mother acted? But she was unable to answer that.
Each woman have her story. And what I learned through my work with Women for Women International, and that's actually the reason why I even started working on the book, wanting to tell my story rather, is it takes a lot of courage to talk about our own stories. It takes a lot of ownership. But we need to own it. I realized that I had been someone who had been talking about other women's stories and preaching other women to break their silence, because that's how I believe we can change the world to the better if we just talk about injustice. But I wasn't willing to break my own silence.
Mm-hmm. And so that question remains unanswered. And even her girlfriends, who you've gone back to visit, can't go there.
They can't go there, but I do think that, and I didn't push either, because out of respect for their own privacy and for everyone's privacy. But Saddam's trial does present an opportunity for us to document his crimes against women. It is unfortunate that none of the crimes that he has been indicted for includes crimes against women. And we have to take that opportunity, Saddam's trial opportunity, to talk about his violence and his state-sponsored violence towards women. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's the only way, it's by telling our truth, that's the only way where we can seek our reconciliation and seek a new vision for the country.
Well, and here you are telling your story for the first time, but Saddam Hussein's henchmen are still out there. Aren't you afraid?
There's always the fear. A friend, when I told her I'm writing this book, and she's like, but aren't you afraid of his daughters or his grandchildren? And there's always a situation where we are justified to be afraid. Again, we can't change if we don't talk. We can't change. We can't stop injustice. We can't keep our silence. Nothing will change otherwise. Mm. So I can't be someone who goes to other countries and preach about how important it is for women to talk when I'm not willing to talk. Mm. And are there risks? Definitely. Mm. Is it worth it? I think that's the only way we can do. And if this is a jump that the society takes, and I hope they take through Saddam's trial, this has been just my personal jump at trying to tell the truth.
Zainab Salbi, again, Saddam Hussein's trial has started. Your mother died so young. What would you want to tell her today?
I told the story, Mother. I documented her truth. You know, when she came to America for treatment, I used to take her to my office and have her read other women's letters through our sponsorship program, where we connect women in America with women in different war zones. And we asked each sponsor to send $27 a month and exchange letters between the two women. I remember reading letters like of one Bosnian woman who she wrote, "I lost the eye in me." And I remember my mother telling me the exact same thing as we were in that relationship. "I am losing the eye in me." I promised her that I will document what happened to her, and I will tell the truth just to, so other women can be maybe encouraged to break their own silence. I love her so, so much, and she, in many ways, through the hardest point of my life, whether it's her death or my arranged marriage by her, she gave me the best gifts that a mother can give to her daughter.
Zainab Salbi, whose mother died at 52. Zainab's new memoir is called Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam. For more information on Zainab's group, Women for Women International, go to our website, here-now.org. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Workers at the auto parts giant Delphi agreed this week to massive pay cuts. Some people making $27 an hour will soon be bringing home $10 an hour. Things aren't much better at General Motors, where the United Auto Workers Union agreed to cut health care benefits to save GM more than $3 billion a year. Well, joining us to talk about how these shakeups in the auto industry might be affecting the rest of us is Thomas Pally, an economist and founder of Economics for Democratic and Open Societies. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, historians, labor historians, are quoted as saying today that they can't remember a moment during an economic recovery when so many at one company were asked to give back so much all at once. Why is this happening when we understand there has been a recovery?
Well, Robin, it really is quite a remarkable period. We are in the midst of a major wrenching transformation. This is very clear evidence of globalization and its impact on wages and employment conditions for American workers.
Is it as simple an equation as Delphi's workers at their very successful plant in China make $3 an hour and the American workers made 27? Is it that simple an equation?
I think it really is. What we have is we have created a global marketplace. So today, firms are going around the world, scouring the world for the cheapest supplier, and then they come back to the U.S., and they say to their suppliers and their workers, meet the China price or you lose the business. Mm-hmm. And that is essentially what's going on at Delphi.
Well, in addition, at Delphi, vacations are going to be cut from 6 weeks to four, pension plans lowered, paid holidays shrinking from 17 to 10. But while the workers are taking huge cuts, the corporate managers don't seem to be. Delphi is looking to sweeten severance packages for 600 managers, with bonuses approaching $3 million for some of them. So the equation of the workers doesn't seem to match the managers.
Right. Well, I think this is what people have been saying about globalization all along. The first is, again, what people have talked about, the race to the bottom, and the boosters of globalization have said there's no evidence of the race to the bottom. The Delphi story really is the evidence. It is the smoking gun. We're seeing it not just in terms of wages. We're seeing the cuts in terms of benefits, as you've mentioned, holiday, health insurance. The whole range of social protections are under attack. And side by side, you see this creation of this two-tier society. Anyone who's in the hierarchy of control at the top end does well. And the working people who are put in competition with other workers around the world are the people who feel the pain and suffering.
How is that possible? Why hasn't there been more of an outcry in the labor movement?
The labor movement has protested this for a very long time. It's up against tremendous forces that are seeking to discredit its arguments, discredit the movement. The UAW has done the best that it can to counter these things, but you have to realize policymakers have intentionally created this global marketplace. And if you want to understand how it works, I mean, the best example is what happened in the retail industry. Because what this is the business model that has long been adopted by companies like Walmart and the other big box discount retailers. They long ago set up this business model of going around the world, finding the cheapest supplier in Mexico or Indonesia or China, and then putting them in competition with a U.S. producer or supplier. And now what we're seeing is the same business model is being adopted in the auto parts supply industry. People write these things off. They say, oh, that's old technology. That's the old industry. But guess what? It's happening in aviation too, which is sort of the state-of-the-art industry. Boeing's new 787 aircraft will be produced on the same business model, parts sourced globally.
Well, are you saying then, Thomas Pally, that the reason that companies can get away with reducing wages for workers, raising them for management, is that there are that many more workers around the world than there are managers?
That's part of the issue. I mean, we have indeed opened up the global economy, and we've essentially, over the last 15 years, we've added about 2 billion workers to the global labor force, and that has to put downward pressure on wages. That's what these business model paradigms are about. They take the 2 billion workers, they then put them in competition through these new arrangements, and hey presto, there you've got it.
Can you give us some other examples of places where this is happening, this downsizing and waging, where it might be a little off the radar?
Well, the metaphor I use is a little like a clock. The hands of the clock start off at 1 o'clock. Think of that as being the apparel industry. They downsize it, move it offshore. Then the hands of the clock move on to 2 o'clock, and that's the textile industry. 3 o'clock is steel. 6 o'clock is auto parts. It's actually now moving into the services industry as well. So basic architectural work can be done offshore. Accounting, people talk about being done in India. Programming done in India. Radiologists, of highly trained specialists and medical professionals, the work can be done in India. So we've been through, worked our way through the manufacturing sector. We're now starting to tackle some of the service and knowledge industries, which used to be non-tradable.
Well, it's apparently hitting your local grocery store. We understand grocery workers at the 71-store Farmer Jack chain, which is in Michigan, all agreed to take a 10% wage cut. Hundreds of workers at a hose plant in Auburn, Indiana, approved a $2 cut in their 18-an-hour pay to keep that plant open. And police officers in Wyandotte, Michigan, agreed to a 3-year wage freeze.
Well, Robin, the way to understand that is obviously the police officers are not in competition with the folks from offshore who are providing police services, and nor are the grocery workers. But what happens is you hit the paychecks of the people who are in competition with those workers, then they have less to spend, and therefore those who service those households, and that means the policemen, that means the grocery workers, they have to take a pay cut. So it actually comes back even to hit public sector workers, because the tax base that pays the wages of public sector workers will be eroded by this process.
We're talking about paychecks shrinking because of workers either being asked to or offering to give up part of their pay and giving up part of their benefits, but there are other external forces that make a paycheck shrink. I'm thinking of the cost of living, and we're watching energy costs rise. Are we approaching a time where workers' pay is not going to keep up with the rising cost of living?
Well, that's been the case for the last year. Essentially, Americans have been experiencing shrinking paychecks on average for the last year. And there's been pretty much no paycheck growth for the last 5 years. I mean, you have to go back in economic history a little bit here. But after World War II through to about 1980, American workers experienced rapidly growing paychecks. Since then, there's been stagnation with an occasional little catch-up as happened in the 1990s, and then more erosion today. So the problem is the economic system has been designed in a way that what cake is being produced is now being split very unfairly, and it's about a change of arrangements, and people have to sort of address that issue. The problem is systemic. You can't blame individual workers. The productivity numbers, so these workers are more productive than ever, and yet they're not getting a slice of that increased productivity.
Thomas Pally, economist and founder of Economics for Democratic and Open Societies, about the incredible shrinking paycheck. Thomas, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a great pleasure.
Still to come, artist Thomas Hirshhorn's view of utopia, it's shrouded in camouflage. You're listening to Here and Now. It's that time of year again when tourists flock to New England to see the fall foliage. My house has been filled with friends who've come and found rain. A personal disappointment, but a financial loss as well. Leaf peeping is big business. New Hampshire alone projected a $1 billion boon from leaf-driven tourism. So far, October's been something of a wash. The big Columbus Day weekend rained out, and September was unusually warm. But there's still time, says Ken Phillips of Yankee Magazine. Ken, give us an overview. How is the fall color looking?
Well, for the most part, the color this year has been between a week and a half to 2 weeks late. When you compare it to typical years. And, of course, we have had some absolutely horrible weather over the last week. The good news is that many of the leaves are still green, so the season is by no means over.
Well, now explain how it works, because when you say they're green, it means they might still turn colors as opposed to being brown and dead. But remind us, how do they turn colors?
Well, traditionally, there are a number of factors that really tie into why leaves change color, but the big one is temperature. And we're looking for that cold, hard frost that really jump-starts the leaves into making that transformation. Over the last couple of weeks, we've just had incredibly warm weather, even in northern New England. So we're waiting to see that cold, hard frost to get that color show really started.
And this involves chlorophyll and anthocyanins.
Absolutely. And actually, chlorophyll is always there. You could almost think of this as putting on makeup in reverse. When the leaves become stressed, the plant can no longer produce the chlorophyll to make up for the amount that it's losing. So you're actually seeing those colors come to the surface.
So the colors, the green's being drained away, or?
The green is being drained away, and those colors that are always there, those chemicals, are becoming visible.
Well, when you look out your window now, what are you seeing?
Well, right outside of my window, I'm seeing a mixed bag of color, which really is what people can expect to see throughout New England right now. So you've got leaves that are just starting to turn, you've got leaves that are at peak, and you do have some leaves that have already passed peak and are actually getting ready to drop from the trees.
But you're up in New Hampshire, north of us here in Boston. That means that we still have a chance of getting some color.
We do. And even here in New Hampshire, there is just so much green left on the trees that I think this could actually still be a very good foliage year if we have not only that good cold, hard frost, but also some nice weather.
That's Ken Phillips of Yankee Magazine on the phone from his office in New Hampshire. And this note, turning leaves somehow made their way into the story that often feels as if it's worming its way into every aspect of American life. The investigation into the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame. Lewis Scooter Libby, the Dick Cheney aide identified by New York Times reporter Judith Miller as her source in the case, wrote a note to Miller that intrigued prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald. First, because of questions as to whether or not Libby was trying to influence Miller's testimony about their conversations, but secondly, because of a reference to aspens, the trees that blanket the West. According to Judith Miller, Fitzgerald asked her about the closing lines. Out west, where you vacation, the aspens will already be turning, Libby wrote. They turn in clusters because their roots connect them. Their roots connect them? What does that mean? Arborists have rushed to explain that, in fact, aspens do turn colors in clusters, a beautiful yellow, in fact. But that hasn't stopped conspiracy theorists from having a field day. What was Libby saying? That he and Miller are connected? If he goes down like a felled aspen, does she go too? Or is it some kind of veiled reference to former Wisconsin Congressman and Clinton Defense Secretary Les Aspin, who dated Miller in the early 1980s? Judith Miller says she was asked by Fitzgerald to interpret the message. She explained that she'd been at a rodeo in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, 2 years earlier. She was approached by a stranger wearing jeans, a cowboy hat, and sunglasses. It turned out to be Scooter Libby. Oh, great. That explains everything. Now bloggers just have to figure out, why was Scooter Libby, disguised as a cowboy, sneaking up on Judith Miller at a rodeo? Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Artist Thomas Hirshhorn rose to fame by creating giant collages with inexpensive materials, room-sized pieces that illuminate aspects of consumer and political culture. The Swiss-born artist lives in Paris but was in the U.S. recently to celebrate the opening of a new installation at the Institute of Contemporary Art here in Boston. Utopia, Utopia uses camouflage, you know, the uniform shared by soldiers in Iraq and fashion-forward civilians, as a symbolic equalizer. He uses mannequins, everyday objects, a philosopher's text, and miles of packing tape to surround viewers with the question of what it means when a costume of war becomes a style. In her review of the show, critic Roberta Smith wrote that Hirshhorn's art is some of the best being made today. She also said that walking through the show calls to mind an Army-Navy store run by a madman and the inside of Jonah's whale.
Very nice. Can we walk around? Yeah.
Here and Now's Deborah Becker joined the artist and chief curator Nicholas Baum at Boston's Institute of Contemporary Art to ask Hirshhorn what inspired his utopia.
First of all, the word utopia. Utopia is a very fashionable now term. Also, I wanted to do twice the name, Utopia. Utopia is a multiplication. I like this repetition. In a way, they were more important when you repeat the word Utopia, Utopia. And in another way, it gets more empty because it's a little bit stupid to say it again. For me, it's not about, I'm not judging here anybody who wears camouflage or wears not camouflage. It's not about this. It is to use this pattern to say we are in one world and we are responsible for the other, in a way, you know, and each other is the other for me. So this is utopia.
Oh, my, I didn't realize how big it was.
Yeah, no, it's in those rooms in the back as
how,
well.
How big is it?
About 5,000 square feet. It's our main exhibition space, two floors. So Thomas has also taken over areas that we normally don't use for exhibitions, like the staircase is now covered in camouflage. The atrium space has camouflage mobiles hanging in them. So Thomas has, I think when people arrive here, of course, what they will suddenly be struck with is the incredible density of this exhibition. Literally, floors, walls, ceiling, three-dimensional objects, images, sculptures, found objects, dioramas, mannequins, texts everywhere. I mean, it's a kind of sensory assault, in a sense. And so it's a very intense experience.
Mm-hmm. And what's one of the questions you hope you make people think about a little bit or sort of enter into people's minds from maybe this particular part of the exhibit itself or the exhibit as a whole?
Why, when I'm wearing camouflage myself, I am responsible for what happens in Iraq. I'm responsible for what happened in Palestine. Why, when I like to be a hunter or a fisherman and to wear camouflage, why I should be responsible for for destruction, for violence in the world and war in the world. There are some photos I made in Paris on the street with people who wears camouflage. Yeah. Camouflage is something abstract, you know? And that's why it works in Afghanistan, that's why it works in the Bronx, that's why it works in Switzerland. It's an abstract thing, a beautiful thing, in fact, a pattern themselves, you know? I try to give them another form, a more autonomous form and a liberated form. That's why I made this kind of mobiles.
Wooden mobiles,
yes,
that you painted.
With these colors, mm-hmm. who correspond, of course, to the colors of the wall and of the floor. So this is just a form who is liberated from the whole meaning, you know? Yeah. And everything here has a part of text, an integrated text, a part of a signature, a caption, a sentence, an excerpt.
There are four televisions here running, and these videos run sort of continuously of different musicians wearing camouflage while they're doing their music videos.
The music videos all has something common. They're different groups. It's not about the sound, that's why I put them out. But I like that there is something common, you know, to this.
Now, some of the text on top, such as dream ethics and assertion of freedom, explain that.
Yeah, so it's a very important part, the integrated text here. I wanted to cut just extracts of the text without looking what it means, but there is always a meaning, of course. I am for the free friendship between art and philosophy. Everybody creates, I create form, and the philosopher creates the truth. He creates concept. He is an artist as well, like me. And I like this absolute understanding as an art, as an act of absolute creation. I think that this universality from camouflage is not only connected to the fighter aspect, but also even to a kind of artistic aspect of an abstract form. Also, and it gives me back to the fascination who artists had in the beginning of the last century when camouflage comes up and when the armies, for example, the British army asked artists to make camouflage on their ships and on their tanks.
Is there another part of the exhibit that you could show me?
Thomas has used mannequins from children to adult figures clothed in camouflage, sometimes wearing these kind of necklaces of language statements. But also some of the mannequins have these very disturbing camouflage outgrowths where they're kind of mutating, or these tumor-like growths which become very sculptural but also very bizarre and disturbing.
Is this the part of the exhibit that you've gotten the most reaction about thus far? Or
I think people are kind of astounded by the sheer physical experience of this dense layering of images, forms, texts. Thomas has kind of created this very particular spatial and visual experience that is unlike anything that's ever been here before.
Corridors of mannequins, and then we have sort of constructed dividers here, painted
right.
in
cardboard
camouflage.
Walls,
right, cardboard walls.
This is a model. This is, in fact, there are two models. One model is more a model of a city, of a street, of an urban space, and this is a model of a house with different apartments, and everybody in this house wears camouflage.
I read that you were a military officer.
I was, yes, I was.
Did you wear camouflage?
Of course.
Yeah. Do you still have camouflage now?
No, of course, no. When I was in the Swiss Army, yes, I had to wear camouflage. I am a warrior. As an artist, you have to fight for your goal as an artist. But I was in the wrong army.
Here and Now's Deborah Becker walked through Utopia with artist Thomas Hirshhorn and curator Nicholas Baum at the ICA here in Boston. The show continues on. For more and to see images from the show, visit an online gallery at our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.